Coming to you from the wormhole that stole half your socks, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Why is it always the left ones?
Everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Marissa. And I didn't drink a drink of water right before we started this segment this time.
I'm so proud of you.
It's the first time we have recorded this where I have not taken a huge drink of water right when I'm supposed to be saying my name.
What can I say? We all learn and grow in many different ways. Would you guys like to hear a timely fun fact?
We would.
Timely?
Oh, yes.
I mean...
Breaking news. My state is on fire.
Uh-oh.
Oh, Lord. The whole thing? I mean, Montana's a pretty big state.
Oh, last we checked, 40 out of 53 counties were under some kind of fire hazard.
Dear God, that's so many.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That is the whole thing.
So many. Yep, we got thousands of firefighters working in Montana. We got the Montana National Guard out to fight the fire in Phillipsburg. There are 21 active fires, and altogether they cover 438,000 acres. And the fire is—it's close. There, I could drive to it about an hour away.
What?
Yeah, one of them is. That's the Lolo Peak Fire. There's one that's up at Sealy Lake. That's the really bad one. That's the largest one right now.
Have they had to like evacuate people?
They have had to evacuate a few people, yeah. The Lolo Peak Fire, they've had to evacuate about 300 homes.
Dang.
There are most places near a fire are under evacuation warning, which is like, hey, get ready to evacuate at a moment's notice because this thing could go pear-shaped soon.
Dang. Gosh. Okay, so I know literally nothing about these fires. What happened? Like... you know how California's on fire like every single summer? Is this common in Montana? Like, what happens to make this a thing?
It is actually common for Montana to have a fire season. Like, the fact of the matter is, things catch here. It gets dry and crunchy, and it's kind of high desert, and lightning strikes, or someone throws out a firework, or whatever, and it burns. And that's okay, because it kind of clears undergrowth, it sometimes helps, like, things grow back better. So this year, it's a combination of some bad forest management, and what happened was we had a really, really rainy, wet, snowy spring, or
that
winter.
Sounds like it would help.
Yeah.
Oh, it usually does, except it made the grass grow really high, okay, and then a drought hit. The areas, most of Montana is under exceptional drought, which is like the worst kind of drought.
Sounds like it.
All that lush, beautiful grass dried right the heck up. And so when these fires that kind of start anyway, they just naturally start, when they started a month early, and they got out of control really fast, and... they keep burning. Our fire season has lasted a month longer than usual. Usually the heavy September rains would put them out, but there's no forecast for rain.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's rough.
That's very
bad. And there's like the pine beetles are eating up the forest, which isn't super great. We don't have them too bad here, but that's a big problem in Colorado. Pine beetles just basically obliterate trees. And
so you have a lot of dead wood to burn.
Exactly. So some people say that, you know, forest management needs to be better, which is probably partially true. This drought is the worst one we've seen in a long time, though, and I guess what time it is. It's time for a public service announcement. Hi, everyone. I'm Science, and I'm a conservative Republican, and I don't like government restriction on business any more than the next guy. And the thought of that is what keeps a lot of people saying that global climate change is a myth, because it's way easier to say it's a myth than it's real, but I don't want to deal with the consequences to my business. But it is real, and I'm a scientist, and I've done the research, and I know that it is, and please stop treating it like a political issue. You'll kill us all.
That is a heavy public and that has been a announcement.
So your personal efforts to fight global climate change, like use less power, eat a little less beef, you know, recycle, whatever, that's admirable, and go you. But the biggest contributors to global climate change are, in fact, industrial. So what needs to change is policy. So if we can somehow convince Republicans that A, the science is legit, and B, climate change is not a political issue, it's a life issue, then I think we could get somewhere. I'm so frustrated with my party sometimes. Anyway.
Science, you said 40 out of 53 counties in your state are on fire?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's a lot.
Listen, I'm far enough from the fires that I'm not in any danger of needing to be evacuated, but because we're so close to three of the biggest ones, all of the smoke is hanging out in Missoula Valley, and there's an inversion layer, right, where the smoke doesn't really dissipate at a certain temperature, so, but that temperature happens to be right where the tops of the mountains are, so the smoke just stays.
Ooh.
It stays. It's so smoky here. You can't go outside. It's awful.
And Montana, if I understand, Montana and California are not the only states having this issue.
It's pretty much the whole West.
I have heard British Columbia, too, so...
Yeah, parts of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Oofed.
Why is this not being talked about? I mean, I know it's being... You've talked about it, but I think I just... It never clicked for me until recently when I really started seeing people post pictures and...
It's because of a couple of cute kids named Harvey and Irma.
True.
I mean, frankly, the population centers are much, much bigger out here. Like, two firefighters have died, but that's pretty much the only casualties in my state. Mm. Because people don't live here much.
Unlike
Whereas
Houston.
Harvey... Harvey's killed how many people? We don't know? Hundreds?
No, we don't know. But it's really like, how many people it's displaced and how long it's going to take to get back.
Not to mention, Irma's already doing damage. Poor Barbuda. Like...
Yeah. Puerto Rico as well.
God.
Anyway, I'm sick of talking about this. Rissa, you have an interesting colloquium for us, I hear.
Yes. So, I've said several times now that whenever I was finished telling the story of St. Joan of Arc's life, I want to talk about how she's been represented in art. But as I sat down to work on this, I realized that that's not really how I should have phrased it.
Rissa, what is the truth?
There's a lot of art depicting Joan, and I don't have time to talk about it. So what I really want to talk about is the representation of religion in art. Specifically, the representation of religion in art made by people who aren't part of the religion they're representing.
Interesting.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure this happens for lots of religions and all of them a bit differently, but because I'm a Christian, the only religion I really have the skills or knowledge to make judgments about is Christianity. So what I'm going to talk about this time and next time and possibly after that is how Christianity has been portrayed in art made by non-Christians. I've studied Christian theology a little bit, and so when I look at these representations, I kind of know what's accurate and inaccurate, that kind of thing. And I
will say, you have studied Christian theology a little bit, meaning you don't have a degree in it, but you have taken several more classes than I have.
So I don't actually have a degree in theology, but I do have a degree in philosophy from a Christian school, and I took a lot of biblical study classes and things like that while I was there. I'm looking for kind of the right and wrong of representation, but a lot of what I'm looking for isn't really where people are incorrect, it's what they leave out. It's about where people put their emphasis. So I'm not looking at people who aren't Christians attacking Christianity. I'm not going to talk about art in which Christianity's the bad guy, and I'm just going to berate them for saying that. I'm looking at art where people who aren't Christians paint Christianity in a good light, but one that I think is a little incorrect. And I have two examples. One I'm going to talk about this week, one I'm going to talk about a few weeks from now, and they are both related to Saint Joan of Arc, I promise. One of them a lot more than the other. But before I start, I wanted to just say that I am not by any means saying that the art I'm discussing is bad art. If it was bad art, I wouldn't want to talk about it. I'm also not saying that having inaccuracies like this makes it worse art. I'm not making aesthetic judgments. As someone who has studied aesthetics, I have to be really clear about this. I am not making aesthetic judgments based on these things. So it's very good art. That's why I'm talking about it. I really like this art, and that's why we're talking about it. That kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, yeah. So the first one is the one that is significantly more associated with Joan of Arc, because it's a play called Saint Joan.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So this play was written by George Bernard Shaw and premiered in 1924, 4 years after Joan was canonized as a saint. I got to see a really wonderful production of this at the Dunmore Warehouse in London back in March. I actually got to watch it 3 times in about a 3-week period because it was part of NT Live, which I've mentioned before. If you ever see NT Live encoring this show, I charge you right now, you must go see it. It's the best thing I've ever seen on stage, and I'm in love with it.
Got it.
It was very much seeing this play that inspired me to do this whole series on Joan, really, that I put together for this podcast.
Can confirm that is all she talked about for, like, a month.
About a month,
it
yeah.
was. I Everything. Mean, I'm not
honestly,
it was really
I could do another 3 full episodes about this play, but you guys asked me not to, so we're going to try to get this done in one. Now, the real problem about talking about this play is that you two haven't actually seen the play, Saint Joan.
We have not.
But no. We know how it ends.
Despite your best efforts.
You do. Well, do you know how it ends?
I think she does.
There isn't a great way to describe this because it's. I already gave you guys a 3-episode-long biography of Joan of Arc, and this play also tells the story of Joan of Arc. So I'm going to try to summarize it as quickly as I can. I've organized this by scenes because I think Shaw does this really interesting way of storytelling. There are no battles in this play, and she doesn't actually get burnt at the stake on stage. Almost all of the familiar action of Joan's story occurs off stage. In fact, the play has very little physical action in it. It's just people talking. All the battles, the king's coronation, Joan's execution, they all happen off stage. And, sometimes there's a great deal of time that occurs between these scenes, and you just have to understand that time has passed. One of the really interesting...
So it's much more like character dialogue development
yes,
focused than it is like...
Yes, very much, character dialogue development focused. This has a couple of really interesting effects, and one of it is that it forces him to either summarize the action that has occurred since you last saw, so in the next scene, be like, well, this just happened. Or what he actually does more of is it forces characters to predict what will happen next, and you just have to assume that they were correct in their predictions, which is pretty interesting. It allows for some really interesting dynamics of people all acting on what they think will happen, and it's really interesting to do it in a play about someone who is recorded to have prophesied a few times. Yeah, so I just think that's interesting. But okay, I said I was going to summarize this, so let's go. This play has 7 scenes, the last of which is an epilogue. So there's not a formal 3-act structure. The performance I saw did the first 5 scenes, then had intermission, then did the last scene and the epilogue. And I think this is pretty standard. I've noticed that these scenes tend to have 2 unofficial parts. Basically, at the beginning of each scene, Joan isn't on stage. And the men, I should mention, Joan is the only major female character in this play. It's rather telling that she's surrounded by just men all the time.
That's annoying, but
I think there is 1 minor female character, but like she's so minor she was cut from the performance I watched and it was like an improvement. These men start the scene discussing whatever trouble they're in or whatever, and then Joan comes in and things start to change. There are 2 scenes that break this, but they still have kind of a moment where Joan... One of them has kind of a moment where Joan speaks up and things change, and the other one, there's 1 scene that Joan isn't in. And her place as kind of the person who comes in and changes things is actually taken by the Bishop Pierre Cochon, who presided over her trial. Anyway, okay, so scene 1 is Joan meeting Robert de Beaurecourt, getting him to center to the Dauphin. I can't, I'm so bad at French. Scene 2 is Joan meeting and being tested by the Dauphin in his court. Scene 3 is Joan meeting Jean de Dunois, the miracle of the wind changing, and her lifting the siege of Orléans. So those are all really, really quick. Those happen, and you just kind of have to infer that other stuff happened in between. The 4th scene is the scene Joan isn't in. This is the conversation to kind of introduce the villains, if they are villains, the Earl of Warwick his chaplain and also the bishop, who will later oversee Joan's trial. They talk about politics and heresy and stuff like that. I say if there are villains because Shaw was actually criticized for not villainizing the bishop enough. I can talk about that later, but I'm going to finish the summary. Okay. Scene 5 is the scene before intermission, and it's what I consider to be the emotional turning point of the play. It occurs right after de Dauphin is crowned king in Reims Cathedral, and it involves Joan saying that they must press on to push the English out of Paris. It's in this scene that all of her loyal supporters, all the characters, they begin the scene in high spirits, celebrating the king and his victory, and Joan. And then as soon as she speaks up, one by one, they turn on her and say they can't support her. They're not able to save her. If she loses a fight, and she will lose a fight, she's all alone.
Ooh.
Intermission generally comes after that, and the sixth scene is the fulfillment of this prophecy. It's Joan's trial. We don't get to see her get captured. We don't ever see her in prison. We just see the trial. It's really long and takes up almost all the time after intermission. It's really, really good. And scene 7 is the epilogue. Now, this is the weird one. It's going to take a little more explaining. The epilogue's really strange, and it occurs a couple decades after the rest of the play. It's basically this weird dream sequence that starts by telling the audience some of what happened while the characters after Joan's death, and it brings their spirits together to talk in this dream that the king is having. It's really weird.
That's very strange.
Yeah, the performance I did actually just trimmed it down really, really, like, trimmed almost all of it away until it was this little bitty scene, kind of just bringing out the bit that really worked. But I want to try to discuss the play more generally in case people watch other performances. So each of these characters that come together in this dream to talk laud Joan. Even the characters who killed her say how great she was. And then in the middle, Joan finds out that she has been made a saint. Like I said, this happened only 4 years before the play premiered. So this is news. And Joan is astonished by this, and also by how everyone is lauding her. And she says that as she's a saint, she can do miracles, and since they all love her so much, she offers to come back, to rise from the grave, a living woman. The reaction to this is pure fear. Everyone, her
friends, her
foes,
one by one,
give a reason why she can't or shouldn't or mustn't come back. It would disrupt everything. Dunois' line is actually my favorite here. It says, "Forgive us, Joan. We are not yet good enough for you." And the play ends with Joan alone asking, "O God that madest this beautiful earth, when will it be ready to receive thy saints? How long, O Lord, how long?" That's the play. Okay, the reason I talk about the epilogue so much is it's gonna kind of be my main example.
Because it's super weird?
Yeah, I just want to talk about it a little more.
Okay.
That was my summary. The first time I wrote this, it was about 5 times longer than that, so be proud of me.
I was there when you were writing it. It was great.
Yeah. Okay, so I do want to talk about this and about representation, but I want to stop for questions because I've been talking a long time.
I mean, you're probably going to answer this, but George Bernard Shaw was not a Christian.
No, he was not.
And so, but it seems like he is at least comfortable with portraying this afterlife and Joan as a saint.
Yeah, he doesn't, like, portray heaven or anything. Like I said, it's staged as a dream sequence. Like, the first person on stage is the king, and he's asleep, and then Joan shows up, and he's like, "Oh, are you a ghost?" And she's like, "No, I'm not a ghost. I'm a dream that you're having." And it's just kind of bizarre. He does talk about the afterlife a little bit, and I don't know, it's not great, to be honest. He does this really funny thing, though, actually, because one of the characters, there are two characters who show up who are not in the play at all and just show up in the epilogue. And one of them one of them is kind of this everyday man, soldier, I'll get to him. But one of them shows up wearing a 1920s dress, and they're all like, "What costume are you wearing?" And he's like, "Excuse me, you're the ones in weird costumes. I've come to deliver this letter from the Pope. It says that Joan is a saint." And anyway, so it's a very strange scene. It's very
weird.
Who's
the second character who's not even in the dang play?
So he's a character who shows up and says that he was a soldier, just a normal everyday soldier, and he's in some afterlife. I think it's this weird thing where he's like in hell, but because he did one good deed, he gets one day off, because that's definitely how the afterlife works. And they ask him, what was your one good deed? And he's like, well, it beats me. I tied two sticks together and handed it to some girl who was going to be killed. Because the story was that as Joan was being led to the stake, a soldier handed her a cross to wear because she couldn't have any from the church or whatever. Interesting. And it's, yeah, it's just this strange little scene. It's not really that important. Generally, my comments on the play are that Shaw did his homework. I'm not saying that everything happened just like he said it did, but he really did his homework for this. A lot of the lines from the trial that I read you guys from the documents, he includes in the play. He even makes a note to include that during the first scene when she meets de Beaurecourt, she's wearing a red dress. That's part of the script in the play. So he really did do his homework on this. So I want to commend him for that. So for the most part, what I wanted to look at isn't so much what Shaw says, but more what he doesn't say. I want to talk about his emphasis. Because here's the thing. Shaw is basically who got me to write this whole series. Not because his Joan was so awesome, which, I mean, let's face it, she is.
It's hard not to portray her correctly and also awesome.
Yeah. but the way that Shaw really got me to write this is I realized after I watched it, I started reading the script, is that Shaw doesn't believe her. Now, don't get me wrong, he portrays her in a good light. She's this amazing figure, all that, but he doesn't believe her. And I think it shows. And that's what I want to talk about. Yeah. He knows that Joan believed herself and that other people believed her, and he really cares about that, and he shows it. But I don't think he did. And he thought he could paint her story anyway. And I mean, he did a really good job. But I want to talk about a couple of the ways that he portrays Christianity, both through Joan and a couple other characters like the Archbishop. Oh, I do want to say, I want to talk about how he portrays the beliefs and doctrines of Christianity, not how he portrays Christendom or Christian people or the church. Like that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a difference there. About believing her, though, I think some people would say this is better. It's more objective. It allows Shaw to paint Joan as more like a human. And, like, yeah, he does that very well. One of my favorite scenes in this is the one where you kind of realize how young Joan is and that kind of stuff. But at the same time, it shifts his emphasis a lot. The simplest example I could think of is that Shaw lets his characters talk about God and sometimes about Christ a lot. But he only ever once uses the name Jesus, and then only because it is recorded as Joan's final word. Does that make any sense? How we could talk, talk about Christ, but never about Jesus? Like, you could talk about this figure, this image, but not the man.
Right.
That's the easiest way to phrase this shift in emphasis. Shaw recognizes that there is this figure that Joan believes in. He recognizes the idea that she had, but he doesn't recognize that it's not just an idea of Christ, it's a person of Jesus. And to Joan, it was very much a relationship, both with Jesus and with the voices she heard. He doesn't really portray that. Shaw doesn't really seem to care what Joan believed at all, or much less who. He just cares that she believes. And I think that's what a lot of this boils down to. People who are outside of religion, all they see is that people have faith. They don't ever really bother to find out what the faith is or what the faith is in. They don't really think it matters or that it's important, just that it's there. And I want to say, this is really super extra common in theology at the time, in like the mid-1900s, but it's still a big problem today. People just they see faith, and maybe they even admire it, but they just see the faith. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think this shows up a lot in a lot of different medias, the way different faiths are portrayed.
Yes.
Is that it's more the idea of faith that is portrayed than, like you said, the idea of faith in something. So you could see, like, you could watch three different TV shows with somebody who's Catholic, Protestant, or Buddhist, and it's almost like you're watching the same thing, because they're portraying more the idea of this person has a faith and a belief system and a moral system.
Yeah.
Rather than a particular faith.
Yeah. Very true. And then it's really just...
It's also sanitized.
It's sanitized, it is very sanitized. For sure. But really, it's not that Shaw gets that much wrong about what Joan believes. He doesn't say a lot of inaccurate stuff. It's just that he thinks he knows which bits are important, and he doesn't. And so he leaves in the bits he thinks are important, and I'm standing here like, those aren't the important bits! There's this other really important stuff that you left out. And actually, I'm gonna get a lot more into this when I talk about my second example a few weeks from now. But actually, the example I have written down here in my notes, this reminded me of a song from The Sound of Music. You remember that song Maria sings at the beginning about confidence? I have confidence and confidence alone.
Yeah.
This is that. Shaw depicts Joan as someone who has utmost confidence in confidence, or rather, utmost faith in faith. And while I do think that Joan had a lot of faith in her faith, she had a lot more faith in Jesus. And that matters.
Yeah, I should hope so.
It matters a lot. And it's just not in there. And like I said, I think it's because Shaw just didn't believe her. I wasn't going to mention this, but so one of the interesting things about the play St. Joan is that it was actually published with, attached to it, a set of essays, like short paragraphs that Shaw wrote on different topics. And when I say a set, there were like, I want to say 43 of them.
That hold all? On, like just on whatever, like crocodile mating habits?
No. Let me, hold on. They're on lots of things. They're on, was Joan mentally ill? Let's compare Joan to Socrates. Let's compare Joan to Jesus. Let's look at the church's perspective on justice. Like, lots of things like that he wrote these little essays on. And so, those, when I read them, they just kind of confirmed for me what I already was suspecting, is that he really didn't believe her. That kind of thing. He thought that Joan was a genius, a creative genius, who just almost invented this divine source for her own genius type of thing. Which, like, I don't buy at all.
That's so, like...
That she worked...
How can you remove
that she
yourself
worked...
so much from the culture of the Catholic Church that he thinks that she somehow invented prophecy?
I don't know.
I mean, that's the world that Shaw lived in.
Yeah, it's very much the world that Shaw lived in, as opposed to the world that Joan lived in.
She would have been a psychological phenomenon using the structures of her day to
And he didn't think she was mad.
Yeah.
He actually says that explicitly. He doesn't think she's mad. He doesn't think she's mentally ill. He thinks that she's a creative genius who just didn't know it and used her own, the terms of her time, to translate what she was.
Okay.
Which, like I said, I don't buy. But that's...
Yeah, nor me.
Yeah, that's how he paints Joan. And he's really, like I said, interested in faith and in the confidence it gives her.
I'm sorry.
What? What are you sorry about?
Is there an ice cream truck?
There is, in fact, an ice cream truck. I was just going to not say anything until it left. But yeah, it will go away. It's in my parking lot. What is it doing here?
Just really needs you to buy an ice cream. So yeah, I don't really have time to go any more play by play, but I did have one of my favorite bits that I wanted to just use as an example of how this skew in emphasis can really affect what's said. So the example is from the epilogue. That's why I want to talk about it so much. And it's the part of the epilogue that the performance I saw really brought to the center of, center of the stage, both literally and figuratively. So in the final scene, one of the characters that shows up is John de Strongberg. Now, he's the English chaplain that I mentioned. He's present at Joan's trial, and in that one scene Joan's not in, and he, more than any other character, hates Joan with, like, real venom. Just hates her. He makes a couple statements where he's basically like, if I was not a priest, I would wring her neck myself. That kind of stuff.
Wow.
Hates her.
Question.
Yeah, and he
is
watches
that
her die.
Characterization by Shaw, or is that reflected in the court documents?
That's by Shaw, I'm pretty sure. Okay. So yeah, this is kind of a character that Shaw goes with. So he goes off stage whenever she's being let out to die, and then comes back on stage, basically to report she's dead, I saw it. And he is visibly shaken. So when he comes back a couple decades later in the epilogue, he is an old, humble, gentle man. The kind that just wouldn't hurt a fly. He's an old rector in a priest, a parish somewhere. He's lost all of this pride and venom that he used to have. And he says that Joan saved him. Because he didn't see how evil he was until he witnessed his own cruelty firsthand during her death. He says that her death saved him and turned his evil into blessing. And hearing this, the bishop, who is also there for this dream sequence, says, "Were not the sufferings of our Lord Christ enough for you?"
Woo!
And the chaplain says, "No, because he had seen them in books and read about them, the sufferings of Christ. But it was witnessing someone die because of his own evil that saved him." And the bishop has this really interesting line. "Must then a Christ perish in torment in every age to save those who have no imagination?" Yeah. Ooh. Now, it's been a theme throughout, but especially in the epilogue, that Joan is a Christ, as it were, a Christ figure. And I'm all for that, really. I love that.
I love a good Christ figure. Harry Potter, Wonder Woman, it's great.
It's great, yeah, love it. But the way that this exchange is phrased really brings out the problem I've been trying to point out. In Shaw's mind, it's not the fact of the act of Christ that saves, but purely the strength of an individual's faith that matters. He actually really comes really close to saying this almost verbatim during another scene through the character of the archbishop, that the strength of faith matters more than the truth. Joan's death saves the chaplain because it strengthens his faith, and it's that, the strength of his faith, and not the efficacy of Christ's death, which is what matters in Shaw's mind. Now,
that's
don't get me
so
wrong.
Uncomfortable.
I know, but it's so common. So many people act and think this way. In the church, too.
So Christ almost becomes this inspirational metaphor that can be replayed throughout time.
Yes.
And show,
which, like I said, is super common in the mid-1900s, by the way, in, like, theology. Yeah. So, yeah, very much this figure. Now, don't get me wrong, I actually really like the line, "Must a Christ perish in every age to save those who have no imagination?" I like the idea, because there's a lot to be said for strengthening faith through vivid images and stuff. That's actually one of the reasons I'm very interested in the philosophy of art. I think, understood in a certain way, that line is good. But I don't think Shaw understands it that way. I don't think it's set in the scene in a way that allows it to be understood in the way that I like. And I think it really brings out Shaw's skewed priorities. Like I said, he's not saying anything directly incorrect about Christianity, especially because he's acting through characters who disagree with each other, and you can't be like, well, Shaw believes this one, or whatever.
Yeah.
He just leaves out all of the really important stuff. And that's definitely what I'm going to talk about next time. In the next piece of art that I want to talk about, because you guys didn't actually want three entire weeks of just the play St. Joan, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite things, which is the Dragon Age series of video games.
Once
again, you guys haven't played, so this will be fun. But, yeah, those are also related to both Christianity and Joan of Arc. Hey! So,
okay.
Yeah, so, and I think that'll get us more into the effects of this. So I kind of wanted to observe it as a, like, an observable thing. You can see in Shaw how this happens. And in Dragon Age, I'm going to point out more of the harm it can cause and the really interesting implications it has for true doctrine.
But this is fascinating for me because I've been in Shaw's shoes.
Really?
So you guys both know I did my undergrad in history with an emphasis in Middle Eastern history, particularly Islamic prophecy.
Right.
And
the outsider looking in that situation.
Yeah, I've been the person trying to write and understand an entire religious system and the effects and outworkings of it without actually being a participant in that religious system.
Right.
And it is a very interesting experience. And I remember having discussions with my advisor about it. I don't know if I can even do this because at the end of the day, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And he told me that my Christian faith might actually be something that would help me in that respect, because while I may not be Muslim and I may not believe Islamic doctrine, I know what it means to believe something. To believe something. To believe, like, really believe something in particular, and to believe something in particular that has a historical context and that has played out in history in that way and is based on a historical figure. And
okay, interesting.
But it's fascinating because there are so many times that I would catch myself doing a historical analysis of a theological document and just running mm-hmm. it through every historical paradigm that I could think of. And then I would go pick up a book on church history that was written by a non-Christian and read them do the same thing and just be like, oh my gosh, you can't say that.
Right. Yeah.
And so it was that fascinating experience of really, really tempering how I tried to write and how I tried to think through things, because at the end of the day, I wasn't just writing about some dead, long dead thing. I was writing about something that was very real to millions of people.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
You know, I don't know. I mean, Shaw, I believe he was an atheist. Agnostic?
Yes, that's true.
He was agnostic, an atheist. I mean, that's a very real belief system to a lot of people as well, but it's a very tricky position to be in. I know I was reading a book once about the life of this caliph who thought he was this Islamic messianic figure, and
mm-hmm.
the introduction to the book by the author, who is Muslim, he was writing and he said, you know, this man's life and his actions have been analyzed from every possible angle, political, social, economical, psychological,
mm-hmm.
and everything he said and did has been analyzed from every angle by historians.
It's a lot except, like Joan, let's be real.
Yeah, except one. No one has ever stopped to consider the fact that maybe he said he wasn't a Islamic messianic figure because he really did believe he was.
Interesting.
No one's ever stopped to take his own beliefs about himself seriously.
Even that is quite interesting, though. Wait, does he argue he really believed it? Or does he argue he really was it? Because I think that's the difference. I think Shaw thinks that Joan believed it, but yeah. I think that Joan was it, and that's a difference.
He argues that he argues that he believed it, not that he was it, but still it was that moment for me of looking at that, of just how seriously do you take people. For me as a mm-hmm. Christian, like, everything that you shared about Joan, when I hear that, I'm just like, this is lining up with everything I know to be true. I have no real reason not to believe her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very weird position to be in when you're writing
yeah.
about a religion that you don't believe.
Yeah.
How do you...
I've never really had to be honest. But no, that's a really good question.
And I think it's something that is, like you said, is often poorly done in media, because people just take it as, like, let's just portray a faith thing.
Yeah.
You're vaguely religious, right?
Well, like, what I'm going to talk about next time is fantasy religions, and how fantasy religions try to be mild enough that they don't offend anyone, either part of or not part of any real-life religions, and it ruins them. You can't have a mild religion and have it work, basically.
Nope.
That's not what religions do.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm going to talk about next time, is how the more you try to distance yourself from any particular faith, the more you just completely misunderstand everything about any of the faiths that you're basing stuff off of. I think Shaw does distance himself a little bit, and it might be for the best. One of the ways he distances himself is by not allowing himself to make these doctrinal statements, and maybe he did it because he knew that he didn't understand the doctrine enough to put it in there. Like, I will make up excuses for Shaw to say why he might have done these things which I consider to be inaccurate. And I'm, like I said, I'm not saying it makes it a worse play or anything like that, but I think the way that we talk about these things and the way we portray them really affects people. And what it is what this all really boils down to is that there's a lot of people out there who aren't Christians who think they know what Christianity says and talks about and believes, and they don't. And sometimes it comes out in inaccuracies and saying, like, actually wrong things. But a lot of times, it just comes out in this weird shift of emphasis. And most of the time, it shifts in emphasis to either, it's okay because I have strong faith in, it doesn't matter what, just strong faith in general. Or, it's okay because I'm a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those are just very, very wrong and completely antithetical to the actual truth of Christian doctrine. And yeah, I think it's a problem, and you see it in art a lot. And it doesn't necessarily make the art worse art, but it does really poorly affect everyone who witnesses it if it leads them to think that they know what Christians believe when they really don't.
Right. I would love to know what Shaw meant by that epilogue scene then, where Jonah's saying, how long until the earth is ready to receive your saints? What is going through his mind when he has her saying this? What's he thinking of?
So the theme of the play, if I would put it this way, and I think the Dunmore production really brings this out, like, super well, almost too bluntly, but the theme of the play, Saint Joan, is basically this, and it's brought out in the epilogue. Even though we love Joan, we say how great she is, all this stuff, if she were to come back today, we would kill her. If Jesus Christ were to come back today, we would kill him again. The theme of the play is that Joan is just as modern a revolutionary as anyone else, and no matter how much you say you love her, no matter how much she is the patron saint of France, we would kill her if she was a real person today, seeing the same stuff.
Much the same that
that's
we would
kind
kill
of
Socrates,
the
or...
Yeah, when I say he didn't villainize the bishop enough by some people's book, it's because this is the theme, that the people who killed Joan had their reasons. And it's not that they were good reasons, it's just that they're the exact same reasons we would have. So he doesn't say that they were right to kill her by any means. He's, you know, they're very wrong to kill her. But he presents them as actual characters with motivations. And it really brings across this idea that if we were in this play, we would not be Joan. We would be the bishops killing her.
That's interesting. None of the audience is Joan. You're not supposed to see yourself in her.
Yeah, I think Joan is, I mean, she's human, and he does get that across a couple of times, especially when she's talking to the king. But she really is just such a figure. When she steps onto stage, everything changes. She's so... He has this one line that ends scene one, that there's something about the girl, that she's just something else. He really does mean for us to see ourselves at most in Jean de Dunois, who turns away from her twice, saying, I wish I could help you, but I can't. And at least in Jean de Stromberg and the bishop, as the people who killed her. The worst character in the play is arguably the Inquisitor, who only shows up during the trial and has this really long monologue about the evil of heresy and all this other stuff. But yeah, no, the trial's super interesting because he puts in a handful of judges, at least one of which is honestly sympathetic to Joan. The bishop is not the worst of them, and then the Inquisitor is just like this hardened guy who's seen it all before and that kind of stuff. Anyway, it's very interesting. It's very well done. I really love this play.
I hope I get a chance to see it someday.
I hope you do too. Same. There's also a black and white film of this play on Amazon that's not great. I really didn't like it. Yeah. Not a fan. I mean, I could talk more about this play, or we could move on to something else.
I suppose we do have a post-grad problem.
We do.
Would you like to share that with us?
You're going to talk about it? Or
no,
just in general, we have them.
All the problems.
We got those.
We've established this.
So many.
I do have a post-grad problem, and it's something that we all mentioned as soon as we got online with each other. So, you know how when you're in college and you're busy doing all the things and you're just going in five different directions at once and up all night and up early and doing crazy things, and all mm-hmm. the adults tell you, oh, you think you're tired now.
Oh, Lord.
Just wait till you get older.
Oh, and my least favorite conversation.
And you look at your life and you think, I'm actually doing a lot with my life. I think I have legitimate reasons to be tired.
And you do.
And you do. You absolutely do. I just want to affirm that. But there comes a point where, like, I think they were right.
Oh, darn it. Why do you gotta be right all the time?
Because I'm so tired all the time.
You've been sleeping okay?
I've been sleeping well. Like, too well. Every time I sleep, I just don't want to wake up. Oof. It's just one of those things where, I don't know, I feel like I have more responsibility now. And so, you know, I'm working 2 jobs 6 days a week, and I just started grad school, and I have a really long work commute. And so...
That's a lot.
It is a lot, and I know there are people out there who are probably like, well, I work 7 days a week and take, you know, 15 children and whatever. You know, we can all sit around and compare life situations, but I'm...
Back in my day, we climbed both ways uphill to get to school.
Yeah, we used to dream of living in a shoebox in the middle of the road.
Yeah, so, like, it's just, it's a new phase in my life where I have a lot more things going on all at once than I think I have before, and so it's a different level of tired and learning time management skills. And
yeah, how is it I have 2 degrees and still have not learned time management?
Seriously though,
what happened there?
I could carry on a passable conversation with someone in broken Spanish, and I have no idea, like, when my next homework assignment is due for grad school. It's written down somewhere, and it really frustrates. I know it really frustrates a lot of older people in my life, because they'll, like, my parents specifically, they will ask me specific questions about deadlines and dates and things, and I'll be like, well, I don't know.
Yes.
I have it written down. It's, like, in a file written down, and when I need that information, I will access it, but please don't ask me to access any more information right now in my head.
See, you I'm know, also bad at writing down things. I just have to re-ask people, like, 10 times.
You just forget things like a cool person.
Yeah, I just forget things.
I recently bought a planner for the next year, and I've color-coded things, and I went through. And this
Ooh,
is...
you went full business student.
Every time I bought a planner, I used it for a week and then threw it away.
Well, mine is pretty, and I used pretty colors, so I'm hoping this will inspire me. But I've got things on there for December, and it's like, it's crazy. So yeah, basically my post-grad problem is, this isn't, it's like, I mean, if life is a video game, this is level up for me right now. And so
it got harder.
It got harder, and there's a lot more things to do, and a lot more responsibility. I'm responsible to a lot more people, because one of my jobs now is that, I was doing this before as volunteer, but I'm doing it now as an actual job, as I'm teaching English. And
nice. They're paying you?
They are. And I have triple...
Congratulations.
I have triple the amount of students as well.
Woof!
And
that's
so...
many.
My class went from 4 to 11.
Oh, dang. That's a lot.
Oh, boy.
It's wonderful, and I love it. It's one of probably, like, the best 2 nights of my week, but... I am just so much more tired now, and it's like there are a lot of good things going on in my life. I'm back in school, you know, I'm almost halfway through my first class of grad school. I'm now getting paid to do something that I absolutely love. I have a job that I enjoy and people that I enjoy working with. It's just...
That's awesome.
I didn't expect to be this tired in the middle of it.
Yeah. I learned this a little bit a couple summers ago, that there are a lot of different types of tired, basically. And you gotta identify which type of tired it is. Like, when I worked at a grocery store, I would get tired, yeah, and physically tired from standing up and doing that kind of stuff. But I would get socially exhausted from the amount of small talk I had to make. And there are different ways to cure different tirednesses.
Right.
sometimes you get less tired when you exercise. That's actually what I've found recently in my own life, is if I actually go to the gym, I actually get less tired than if I didn't. Mm-hmm. So, when I said, have you been sleeping a lot, sure, that's a cure for, like, physical tiredness from sleeplessness, but sometimes the cure for tiredness is to go be by yourself for a little bit.
Yeah, and I am... It's not... I've definitely been in places where I had that emotional tiredness, and I'm glad I'm... Like, right now, my tiredness, it's a physical... This is just demanding more of me than I've had to give.
Right.
In the past, and so it's a very physical, like I said, level up sort of tired. I've been in situations where I was emotionally tired, and that was not good.
It seems like a mental tiredness, like just a stress thing.
Yeah, and it's not so much that I even feel stressed. It's just, you know, like I said, I love school, and my English classes especially, like, I love my job and my English classes. I go there and I don't leave feeling tired. I leave feeling like I've been to the gym almost. I'm always excited to get there, and I'm always sad to leave. And so it's all of that. It's just that physical tiredness of there are only so many hours in a day. I'm using them a lot more. And I don't know if there's really
my favorite cure for
that. I don't know what it's a problem I don't have a solution to. Sorry, what's your favorite thing?
I don't either. My favorite, though, was when you texted us the other day and you're like, before I go, I'm going to sleep at 10 tonight, like an adult. And I said, it's 10:15. And you're like, details!
But, so when I texted you that, it's that physically falling asleep, and this is something everyone's like, you just need to retrain yourself to a new sleep schedule. I have been trying to do that since I was 17. For 10 years. I have tried to do this, and physically my body will not shut down before 10:30.
Look, when I was, like, 6, I would wake up at 6:30 in the morning, every day, by nature, and it drove my parents nuts. They were like, stay in bed!
That is not normal.
Don't wake us up!
You've got some kind of, like, special morning person mutation. I love it. Listen, I love it about you, but it is bizarre.
You guys know me. In undergrad, like, people would be like, oh, it's not late, it's just now midnight. And I'd be like, it's midnight? It's past my bedtime, let me go.
Whereas I was the person who was like, if classes started at 2, like, if my first class was at 2, and then went from there, I would be the best student ever.
I would die.
You know, guys want to know what kind of tired science is?
Is it Please smoke share. Tired?
It's smoke tired, because I'm breathing particulate matter constantly.
I'm sorry.
Breathing what?
Do you need like a mask?
Particulate matter.
What's that?
It's the part of the smoke you can see.
Oh, okay.
Do you need like a mask? Like a filter mask?
At a certain point, it doesn't really help.
Oof, that's bad.
It's really... Okay, so you went on the website yesterday when I spouted a bunch of scientific words.
Yes, I did. You were in the unhealthy zone.
Yeah, the constant breathing in of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and other volatile organic chemicals and the particulate matter, it leads to sore throats and... why can't I think of a single thing right now?
Because you're tired.
It leads to disorientation. There
That's
it is.
What?
We can tell.
Yeah, great job.
Was that a solution or an example?
Yes. And it leads to fatigue, and it's not... All I want is to breathe the fresh Montana air. I thought living here was going to be making me close to nature. I'm too close to the fire part.
You need, like, an oxygen chamber.
Oh my gosh, that would be hyperbaric chamber, heck yeah.
Yes. You could get, like, one of those fishbowl thingies, like the squirrel on SpongeBob.
What?
Fill it with oxygen.
What?
Fill it with
oxygen. Are you telling me to get a scuba tank?
Yes. Fill it with oxygen and just walk around like that.
I think part of the tired thing is we're getting older.
This is true.
Ew.
aging is happening and we don't have as much energy as our teenage selves used to.
Dang entropy.
That's part of it.
Did I use that word correctly?
No. You mean just time, because entropy is the tendency of systems to go from orderly to disorderly.
That too.
Does that not happen in our bodies?
I mean, I guess in a great, like a macro, I mean, sort of.
This is more like a universal thing.
Yeah, this is more like time, just the passage of time.
Oh, well, I tried.
Is what this is.
I tried.
You did, and you almost succeeded. And I'm just so tired, man. I just wake up and feel like I'm not being smothered in smoke. I don't think that's a lot to ask.
You know, this is actually how I felt when I, so I've, not the smoke bit, but the other symptoms you're describing. I did not know that I have seasonal affective disorder until I moved north. And this is actually how I felt in winter while I was in the UK. And then spring came, and it was, I had never understood why people liked spring, and suddenly it was just like, oh. And it's really good. So I'm hoping that that happens for you sometime soon, that this smoke passes and you wake up and it's like the springtime.
Listen, I've already had days like that where the smoke isn't quite so bad and I can actually see the blue sky and I'm like, and the mood just brightens right up. That is definitely a psychological effect of this.
Isn't it? So, I've been noticing recently, isn't it crazy how, like, affected your mind and mood can be by physical things? It's weird.
Yep.
It's crazy.
How dare I not be a formless void floating through space? How dare? How do you personally counteract your tiredness? Because I know how I do it, and the answer is coffee, my friend.
Music, actually. I don't drink coffee, so if I'm really tired and I actually have to get something done, I am very intentional in which music I pick. And it changes by circumstance, but being able to isolate myself into my headphones and play music that I want to really helps me do stuff and function. And sometimes it's during work, and sometimes it's just that I have to set aside a time where I can just take a walk and listen to a podcast or listen to some music or something. Music really helps me stabilize my mood.
And this is something I learned about myself in undergrad and right after undergrad, is that schedules are great, but I am the type of person who needs unscheduled time.
Mm-hmm.
At some...
So much. Point I need so much.
Of my life, I need something where I am not trying to get stuff done by a certain time.
Yeah.
And so I know there was a point in undergrad 1 year where I had so much scheduled that literally every bit of my time pretty much was scheduled. And I actually broke down and started crying about it. I was like, I can't breathe. And
stifling.
Yeah, I know I have friends who thrive on that kind of thing and who would find all kinds of unscheduled time just horrifying.
Everyone's different and everyone's got different needs there.
I try to keep at least 1 day a week, and I learned this when I was doing my internship at Disney, that I need at least 1 day a week where I don't set an alarm to get up in the morning. And so I don't feel that pressure to, I have to get up by this time. And
that's good to know about yourself.
Better too.
Yeah, and where I spend the majority of my day not talking to people.
So do you have that right now in your life?
I do.
Good.
It's harder because I'm working 6 days a week, but most of my Monday is that. And it's very intentionally kept that way.
Good.
You know what that's called?
Another
Sabbath.
Yes.
Yeah, imagine that.
Also, it means if I ask you to do something with me on a Monday, it means I really, either A, I really like you, or B, I really want to get to know and like you.
That's so nice.
I like that. I feel like for me, that's, I don't need unscheduled time for myself. I feel like I need time with people where nothing is expected of me. Like, that's why I love D&D so much. It's like, I'm going to get together with a bunch of friends and be a goof and not be self-conscious about what they think about me. Freedom, I think, comes from, like, freedom from expectation for me, less than, like, freedom from schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about what we are into this week.
What are we into?
Y'all had a thing for that, right?
Yeah, I'm into donating to disaster relief funds this week.
That sounds so fake.
Nope, I'm into it. I'm living in one.
Okay.
I'm very into it.
So, just to expand, I think what we talked about was that we're into properly donating to disaster funds. Not just
throwing money at the Red Cross?
That, and not just, like, collecting all the teddy bears from the dollar store and sending them into flooded areas.
They do not need any more teddy bears! Please stop.
You know, stop sending teddy bears and random crap to disaster areas that don't even know yet what is completely disasterized.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I found
Leave it to the people who are there to figure out what they need.
And also, then buy it with the money that you've sent them, because you're going to do it, right?
Yeah. Yes. Support,
you're going to do that.
Support the local economy as much as possible. Like, let them buy from as much local stuff as available. Mm-hmm. And also,
because it needs it.
Like, if you want to volunteer, that's great and awesome, and you should go down there and help them knock down drywall, but please go with a group. Don't just show up your own bad self with nowhere to stay and no plan. And, like,
yeah.
Don't add to the people who need to be evacuated.
For sure.
I think I had someone recently tell me that someone had offered to come down to Florida from a completely safe area and help them get away from the hurricane. And they're just like, why? That would add to the number of people we have to get out.
Yep.
So,
oh my gosh.
I'm gonna link to a New York Times article that I read today that was really good. And it had just a list of ways to most effectively help any disaster-stricken area, be it wildfires, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, you know, we're going to be very global. Since we're talking about global warming, we're talking about global disasters. India, Nepal.
Oh my gosh, the flooding in Niger, there's flooding in Bangladesh, a record drought in South and Central Europe.
Oh, we haven't even mentioned the earthquake in Mexico, which, by the way, will cause a tsunami.
Oh my gosh.
So, yes, there are a lot of things you could donate to, but do it responsibly. And we're going to try
to get...
Don't just send teddy bears. You know, it may make you feel good, but you have not actually done anything.
Yep. Please look up any charity that you donate to on Charity Watch. That's a very good resource. Make sure that their money is actually going to, like, people instead of, like, marketing.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
That and...
Oh, gosh.
Also consider supporting reputable local charities, because they're going to be on the ground a long time after these big people like the UN and the Red Cross and all of those. They're great for...
Yeah, eventually United Way is going to leave the
area. They're going to leave. So, for example, there are still places that are rebuilding from Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Cross is not there anymore. But places like Habitat for Humanity and other local charities are going to be there for a long time afterwards. So... try to look out those and research them as well. And yeah.
I have a few, before we go, I have a few charities you could donate to for Montana.
List them.
Cool.
Okay, so the United Way of Missoula County is the one that people recognize most. United Way of Missoula County. And then there's 406 Family Aid Foundation. Those directly help the evacuees of the Lolo Peak Fire, which, again, 300 homes had to be evacuated. And then the Department of Agriculture is doing something in conjunction with the Stock Growers Foundation. There's a lot of people losing, like, herds of cattle, their entire livelihoods because of the fire. And to donate to them, you can call 406-442-3120. And I'm going to be donating to one of these reputable charities, that's for certain.
You're going to put all this in, like, the blog post.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All of these will have links down there and other information. Oh, boy.
Awesome.
Yeah, but we appreciate it. Like, keep praying. Keep us in our thoughts. And try to do your best to help people in the ways they actually need to be helped.
Yes.
I'd like to thank Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our music, Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design, and today's intro, where we came from Rissa. But if you would like to suggest a place... Yeah, it's you!
It's you!
that if you'd like to suggest a place where we are coming from for a future episode, you can reach us on Twitter at LiberalArnts. You can reach us on Tumblr and Facebook at TheLiberalArnts, and you can always, always email us at TheLiberalArnts@gmail.com.
You should do all of those things, but especially email, because I check the email and it makes me happy. When we actually get
an email. Do you want to make Cleo's day? You could do that. Send an email.
Sounds like a little charity in itself.
It doesn't even cost you anything. And
make a wish foundation.
Yeah.
She's not dying or anything.
I'm not dying. I just love mail. That's why I love Amazon so much. I get to
we
send
just
myself
got
mail.
A letter. We just got a letter. Oh, yeah. Hey, what are we going to talk about next time, Cleo?
Yeah, what are we going to talk about next time?
Well, what do you think we're going to talk about?
Turkey?
No. We're not going to talk about turkey.
What?
What?
I know.
No.
Shock and amazement.
I feel so betrayed and lied to.
I know something about the world other than what has happened in Turkey. Yeah, so we're going to take a break from turkey because I just witnessed a magnificent natural event that didn't involve any death at all. And it was beautiful.
That's so good.
It was beautiful and wonderful.
What?
I got to see the totality of the solar eclipse.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And so I'm going to talk about...
So we're
going
to talk about eclipses?
We're going to talk about eclipses. And I'm very excited, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Awesome. Thanks for listening to The Liberal Arnts. Until next time, learn something worth knowing.